Welcome to History from the Hill of Peace, a podcast that offers a glimpse into the rich 250-year history of Friedberg Moravian Church. Nestled on the Forsyth and Davidson County line in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, we celebrate generations of God's goodness, faithfulness, and love. Relax and enjoy as our guests take us from Friedberg's roots to where we are today.
Welcome to the 13th episode of the History from the Hill of Peace podcast. We're so excited that you've joined us today. As Friedberg Moravian Church celebrates its 250th anniversary, there's so many stories to tell about the church itself, its humble roots, and the people who shaped it. During each episode, we feature a story, read the Moravian Daily Text, and have some surprise visitors join us along the way. Today, I want to introduce a voice that we know super well from other episodes of the podcast, which is Jimmy Snyder. We're so excited to have you back. We've missed hearing your voice on the past few episodes, so we're excited you're back with us. So Jimmy is part of our 250th anniversary committee. He's been the church historian for over 25 years. He's involved in the Moravian Provincial Band, along many other things. Oh, and I can't forget, he's vice president of the Wachovia Historical Society. So we're coming to you today from a change of venue here at the church. We're actually sitting in the church historical room, which is quite fitting for what we're going to be talking about this evening, Jimmy. So you kind of briefed me on where we're going, so I'm looking forward to the information and the history that you're going to be sharing with our listeners today.
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for asking me back again. These have been interesting and a lot of fun to do, so I always look forward to it. Sometimes with my schedule, it's not real easy, but you know, I always look forward to doing them.
Well, we're always grateful to have you.
Well, thank you. Today, we're going to do something a little different than we have in previous ones. We've tried doing some of these podcasts where we give stories about individuals and all. This is going to be a little more about objects that we have in the historical room. We were blessed by our forefathers here that they kept a lot of stuff that was important to the church. And then when this building was built, they put this historical room purpose made for this location and to store our historical items in. So if you've never been down here, this is an invitation to come down and visit whenever we have open houses. In addition to that, I am more than happy if we can work out a schedule to do individual tours of the room also.
Which you do quite frequently.
I do a lot of those, but it's all, you know, if we can work our schedule out to do
right.
It.
Right.
So I invite folks who are listening to this podcast to do, you know, give me a call. Come down and see the room. Whenever we have it open to the general public, come down and see the room.
And from a firsthand experience, this is an amazing room with so much history, and you could just spend hours down here just looking at the artifacts and the photos and hearing the stories and asking questions. I can't tell you how many questions I've asked every time I come into this room.
Well, I try to tell people when I set up individual tours here, we need at least two and a half hours to even get started on a tour of this room and do it justice. A lot of items in here, a lot of history in here. The floorboards of this room came out of our first church that started being built in 1766. And then when that church was added on to in the 1780s, more of these boards were cut. And they eventually went into storage in the old White Church. And they were found when the White Church, the 1823 church, when it was torn down, they were found stored in the attic. And so they have been placed in this room as floorboards to the historical room. And they are beautiful, wide pine boards.
They're absolutely beautiful. They're almost indescribable. They're so pretty.
A lot of people, when they first walk in the room, that's one of the first things they notice is this floor. You know, we have 250 plus years of experience in these floors in here. The people who have walked on these floors. So they have an interest of their own. But I don't want to get into too much detail on that. That was not what I was going to talk about today, but things do kind of...
They change
as we do them, you know. One of the things I wanted to talk about is we have many old Bibles in the historical room. Some of them are in German, some of them are in English, some of them are the large family Bibles, some of them are the large pulpit Bibles that once they get retired, they come down here. We have a large assortment of different size Bibles, different languages, but I picked out three of them today. I want to do just a very brief description of them. And maybe for another day sometime, we can look at some of the other Bibles we have in here.
That sounds great.
But the first one I wanted to look at was the Crater Family Bible. This is a little small. It's the Bible is 3 3/4 inches by 6 1/2 inches. So it's a little small Bible. It's written in German. I don't know the date that it was published. The Crater family gave it to the church a few years ago. And of course, we don't know what the date on the Bible is. The Bible is very fragile, so we do not spend a lot of time thumbing through it, as you might imagine. But the Bible belonged to Maria Fry Crater. Now, you talk about Maria Fry. Fry was her maiden name. And the first burial here was Peter Fry in 1766. I believe he was her grandfather because her mother and daddy were Peter Fry and Katharina Walk. Now the Walk name comes up from earlier stories we did about the headstone that went to Richmond, Virginia, Culpeper, Virginia, and back to here. That was Johannes Walk or Walk. You know, in the family, the Fry and the Walk family. She was born December the 11th, 1766, which was the same year that Peter Fry, Sr., became the first death at Friedberg and the first burial in Our God's Acre. She married Jacob Crater, or G-R-E-T-E-R, Greeter at that time, it's now Crater. She married him on February the 21st, 1786. And then she died on April the 11th, 1837. She was 70 years old when she died. And like I said, her family gave that Bible to Friedberg as a historical item. And we gladly accepted that gift from them. So that's one of the Bibles we have. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail on these because we're going to cover several other things today. The second Bible I wanted to talk about was a 1797 German language Bible. And it is a larger Bible. It is more along the lines of a family Bible in size. It is 8 1/2 inches by 10 inches approximately. It was the Spock family Bible from Adam and Maria Spock. It was their family Bible. Adam died in 1801, and this Bible was published in 1797. So he had only owned it a short period of time before he died. But one of the things that was very interesting in this Bible is in the front flyleaf of it, is handwritten names of all of Adam and Maria's children and their dates of birth.
How fascinating.
Yeah, you know, and if you look, that information was taken, and if you go over to Maria Spock's gravestone in Our God's Acre, it lists all of her children and their dates of birth on there. This is handwritten in the front of this Bible. So I thought that's one we should mention. It is under glass. It was donated to the church many years ago, but it's in a nice case, heavy glass lid on it. You know, you can look at it, but again, it's one of those that you look, but you don't touch.
Right.
That's the way most of our Bibles are in here. You look at them, but you don't really touch them, as opposed to some other items we have that you can touch. The third Bible I wanted to talk about was a 1790 German Bible. And it's a little bit smaller. It's a 5 inch by 8 1/2 inches approximately. It was written in German. I may have already said that. It was owned by Christian David Buchholz, B-U-C-H-H-O-L-Z. And you'll see in the Bible, it's written C.D. Buchholz. Well, he was the sixth minister at Friedberg. And this was his Bible. He was minister here from May the 3rd, 1805, until January the 7th, 1807. So he was only here for about a year and a half. But he was our sixth minister here. And we were lucky to come across and gain ownership of his 1790 Bible. That's just three of the Bibles that we have here. Sometime it might be interesting to do a podcast just on the Bibles that we have, the old ones, that we have in this room, because there are a lot more and they have a lot of history to them. So moving on to something else, you know, not going to dwell on anything a whole lot today. When the White Church was built in 1823 is when they started building it. And if you notice, when you walk in front of the church on Sunday mornings on the sidewalk, where the blessing box is, right beside of it is a cornerstone with the dates 1823 on it. That was the cornerstone of our old White Church, which was the last church here before our current building. They started work on 1823. It was not completed until 1827. So it took 4 years to build the church itself before they could start using it. And at that point, when they got it finished, they took the old churches that were over in the graveyard that were made from logs. They were disassembled and brought over on this side of the road, or the north side of the road, to use as a diner kitchen. But that is a totally different story that we will do at a later date.
Yes, I'm fascinated about that. I'd love to hear more, but yes, let's continue on.
So anyway, the congregation at that time, they didn't have a whole lot of money, because we had just finished building, spent 4 years building a nice two-story frame building that was going to be when it first started, the sanctuary was on the upper level and the pastor's family living area was on the lower level of it. Eventually, over time, that switched. But anyway, they first started looking at pews and what they were going to do for pews inside this newly built church. And the first decision was to do like some of the other churches in the South at the time, and that was to let each family bring their own pews.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And each family set up their own pews. And that started being a bit of a problem in that some of the families were bringing in these really nice things. And I think of some of the readings I've done on it, I think of some of the Anglican churches that have the railings built around the pews and the swinging doors that go onto the pew. So some of the families here, that was their thoughts on a pew. And then you go to the other end of it, which I like to say my family end of it, they would bring in a couple of stumps and a board, put the stumps down, lay the board across it, and that was their pews.
It didn't matter what you were sitting on.
It irritated the leaders of the church to have that big of a difference in the pews that were in the church. So they decided in 1835 that it was time to get some new pews for the church. Let's get rid of all this family homemade pews and let's get some good pews. So they found some woodworkers that lived just south of Friedberg down towards Lexington, and contracted with them to build the pews. And now this is in 1835. I have not found anywhere in the records how much those pews cost to build. You know, how much did Friedberg have to pay for them? But there is some information in the records that it did take 10 years to pay them off.
Okay.
So that must have been a fairly expensive undertaking. Not only that, but Friedberg was having some financial difficulties at the same time and was having to get rid of some of their land to help meet their financial obligations. That was in 1835 when these pews were made. We have three of them here in the historical room. They're in excellent condition. We've got two of them that are approximately 7 feet 2 inches long, and we have one that is approximately 6.5 feet long. So we have three pews in here, and they're currently being used to put books on. One of them makes a beautiful bookshelf under the quilt that the Ladies' Aid Society made. Another one, we have some pictures on it. So, you know, they're being used a lot. One of the interesting stories about this 1835 pews is Advent Moravian Church is one of our daughter churches, along with Enterprise Moravian. Well, when Advent was building their sanctuary and all, they ended up, they needed some pews. And this was about the same time that Friedberg had bought some new pews. They were right in the middle of a renovation of the church, and they were putting new pews in the church. Advent needed some pews, so I don't know if Friedberg gave them the pews or if they sold them the pews, but whichever way it went, the pews ended up at Advent Moravian Church in their Sunday school sanctuary. Now, if you're not familiar with Advent Moravian, they have two sanctuaries that are back to back to each other. And one is their regular sanctuary, one is their Sunday school sanctuary. And many years of my youth were spent in the Advent Sunday school sanctuary, because that's where the Sunday school classrooms were. It's really a nice place, but it had a balcony in it. The 1835 pews that Advent got from Friedberg are in the balcony of Advent's Sunday school sanctuary.
That's fascinating.
So if you ever want to go and see several of these old 1835 pews, they were up at Advent in the balcony up there.
And if you're not familiar with the area here, Advent is not super far from Friedberg.
No, no.
It's what, about a 10-minute drive, if
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's maybe 5 miles from here, something like that. It's not far at all.
So we technically could call them traveling pews, in a sense.
Well, they did take a trip up there. And in fact, several years ago, here at the church, they were discovered we had too many of those 1835 pews here. And the trustees at the time offered up several old antique items that we had multiples of. They all offered them up for sale, and I have one of the 7-foot pews in my house.
Oh, that's great.
So it's always real neat to sit there and look at it and say, well, that thing's been around since 1835, and it's still in good shape, you know.
It is. It's fascinating when you really think about looking at these pews, who sat on them,
you know,
and the stories behind them, and the kids that might have wiggled on them that couldn't sit still during church. You know, you could make up all sorts of fun stories about these pews.
Yeah, you never know. It's just like, I feel some way, you know, you're talking about the pews, same way about the floorboards in here. Who walked on these boards? And you know, what are the stories behind the people who walked on these boards? Same thing with the pews.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But again, I don't want to spend too awful much time on that. You know, that's something we can talk about later. If you come down here for a visit, we can go into more detail on things. We've gone through the Bibles, the three Bibles that were in the room. We've gone through the pews that are in here, the three 1835 pews. Now we're going to go to our third item, and that is a KAS. And a KAS, a K-A-S, is nothing more than German for cabinet. It was made by Johann Kraus in Salem, somewhere in the neighborhood of the mid. I thought earlier that it was probably 1760, but it's probably 1770 until the end of the 1700s is when he made it. When it came into the possession of Friedberg, I'm not sure of. Some records are just, they're not there, so you don't have this information. But the cabinet is made out of walnut, beautiful wood.
Oh, it's very beautiful.
And when you figure how old it is, You know, it's in great shape. It is approximately from the floor to the top of the molding on the cabinet is 6 feet 4 inches. The width of it is about 4.5 feet. And the depth of the cabinet is about 17.5 inches. So it's a good size cabinet. And Krauss was, like I said, he was one of the top cabinet builders in Salem. So this is not something somebody just stuck together. You can look at it and tell it's great workmanship. It has a single door on the front of it. If you look at the door, it has a lock on it and a key that fits in that lock. And that's marvelous, just, you know, when you figure the age of this cabinet to still have the key for it. And when you shut the door, the lock locks the door. So you use a key to unlock the door. It still works. After all these 250 plus years, the key still works and the lock still works.
Someone has taken really good care of that over the years.
Oh yes, it has been a prized possession. The cabinet was owned by the church, but it was used by the parsonage family. And they kept a lot of stuff in it. They kept linens in it. They kept paperwork in it. Just any number of things that you would put in a storage closet at home. This is a storage closet that the preacher's family used. Now, when you open up the door, you see all these great shelves in there. So you can tell it was used as a storage cabinet type situation. But a couple of the things of great interest on this, that every time I look at it, I get more excited about it. When you open the door and you're facing the inside of the door or the back side of the door, there are two pieces of paper that are stuck to the door. On the left-hand side is a piece of paper that had the inventory of what was in the cabinet while it was in the hands of the parsonage family. So everything that the church owned that was in that cabinet was listed on this left-hand page. That's pretty exciting in itself. But then on the right-hand panel of the door is a piece of paper, again, stuck to it. And this has a diagram on it, and it has Friedberg in the middle. A circle drawn in the middle of the paper and Friedberg in the circle. So that was showing Friedberg was the center of the life here at the church in this area, in the neighborhood. And then it has a cross design on it, which reminds you a lot of the British flag. But if you think about it, at that period of time, we were under British rule. So it was not unusual to have something that would look like a British flag on it. The written on this piece of paper is the names of the property owners around Friedberg.
Wow.
I like to refer to it as one of the first register of deeds office, because on this piece of paper, if you look at it close, you can see where names are scratched out and new names are written in.
Oh, wow.
So it looks like, and this is just pure speculation, but it looks like the first names that were written on there were the property owners when this cabinet was brought into Friedberg. And the property owners were listed on this piece of paper. And then whenever that property owner died or moved away or sold the property, their name was scratched through and the new owner's name was written on it. So it's a history. This piece of paper is a history of land transactions and people who lived in Friedberg at the time. There is no date on this piece of paper. It is heavily stained because it was glued to a stained walnut piece of wood. So the paper itself is heavily stained. There's no way of getting it off the door. And you would just totally destroy it if you tried to get it off the door. We've tried several different photography methods trying to get a picture of it that we could blow up and examine a little better. And so far we haven't been real successful of getting a good photograph of it. So that's, you know, something we're going to have to look at one day. But come down for a visit. I'll be glad to show you this Register of Deeds office that was Friedberg Moravian Church. And, you know, if you think about that, we also had our own post office here. We had our own post stamp. Lewis Wrights, who was a preacher here during the Civil War, he was our postmaster here. So we had our own post stamp and everything, Friedberg, North Carolina. But that gets off on another story that
it
we
does.
Can talk about some other day.
There's all sorts of little fun little tidbits that kind of offshoot from these items that we've spoken about today.
Well, that's the reason I tell people when they come down here, you know, if they're coming in to visit and we can set up a time to set aside 2-2.5 hours, because you get talking about one thing and then you see something else in the room which jogs a memory about that, and you end up spending the entire day down here. But I'm happy to do it. I love talking about the history of Friedberg, and welcome people to come in and visit.
Oh, absolutely. And I strongly encourage all our listeners, if you're in the Winston-Salem area, to definitely try to find a time to set up and come check out the historical room. And actually, one time that it's going to be open that I can share with our listeners is coming up in September. We are actually doing, part of our 250th anniversary celebration, we're going to do a walk to the Rock House from the church. And we can go, that's another whole episode that we can talk about as well. But as part of that event, the historical room is going to be open from 1 to 3 on Saturday, September 23rd. So you can tour the room. There'll be volunteers. Jimmy, you'll be down here to answer questions, to kind of share some stories, and just kind of talk about all these different items in the room, from the Bibles to the pews to the cots to everything else, including the floors. You know, the list goes on and on. So, you know, mark your calendar September 23rd if you're going to be in the area. 1 to 3 is when the historical room will be open for sure, that you don't have to make an appointment for. You don't have to really schedule anything with Jimmy or through the church office. So there's an opportunity right there already.
And one thing I'd like to say, if you've been to the historical room before and it was more than 3 years ago, you need to come back. There's been a lot of changes made in here. The room looks totally different than it did 2 years ago. So if you've been before, come back. You might be surprised at some of the new stuff we have in here.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, you're gaining new stuff all the time, it sounds like, which just makes it even more interesting because the history just keeps growing down here. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for sharing the stories about these items today, and I can't wait to sit down with you in the future and maybe talk about some of the other items or some more historical stories. The possibilities are endless, thanks to the 250 years that Friedberg has and everything that has gone along with it. So thank you, Jimmy. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome a new voice to the podcast, Marcia Reich. She was the preschool director for 16 years and recently retired. She's a lifelong member here at Friedberg. She's currently an elder. She's involved in both the adult choir and the handbell ministries. She also teaches the 2-3-year-old Sunday school class and is active in the Women's Fellowship. Marcia, you are a busy lady. But we are excited to have you on the podcast today, and we're going to talk a little bit about Friedberg's preschool, how it came about, and kind of take a deep dive into it and just kind of do a really nice overview. You were the director for 16 years, so you're kind of our source of all things preschool. So I'm really excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk about the preschool. That's been one of my main conversations for over 16 years. Eva Haynes had a vision, I guess, in the winter of 2006, and she went to the elders and asked for a feasibility study to be done in the hopes that they would decide to start a preschool at Freeburg. She had grandchildren that were preschool age at the time, and she's always been an advocate for children, whether it was music or school or whatever. And so they approved it, and she hit the ground running, put a committee together, and in a month, decisions were being made and plans were being made. And then in April, we had already interviewed some ladies for the director's job at a meeting. I don't remember how the conversation went, but they started asking me questions about my background and what I had been doing. I had been teaching kindergarten for a long time. And from that conversation, they decided that they would offer it to me. So after a lot of prayer, because I was happy where I was teaching, I decided that that's what God wanted me to do. And I felt good about it. I felt very inadequate, and I had had the director that I'd worked for most of the time at Ardmore Methodist was very helpful. Jody Pardue and Carolyn Breedlove were current directors at that time, and so they were very helpful also. And together, the committee put all the pieces together, and we started furnishing classrooms and opening registration, advertising, all the things that it took. The congregation was very supportive. We got donations from Sunday school classes and women's fellowship and individuals. The trustees had said that they would loan us $25,000 to get started, but we never had to use any of that.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really awesome. We used the donations, and then once registration opened and then school started and we started taking tuition, we've been self-supporting ever since.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, you know, God makes things happen. When he wants it, he makes it happen. And I really felt that it was what God wanted all along.
So it sounds like the preschool is definitely, it's more than a preschool. It's a ministry and an outreach here at
the
church.
Absolutely, yes. And that's what we aim for. I mean, we not only plan activities for the children, we reach out to families and try to welcome them into our church as well as the preschool.
So if you've been listening to our podcast, you know, we're celebrating 250 years, and school has a really long history connected with Freeburg. Basically, there's been a school in the area pretty much as long as Adam Spock has been in the area. So the preschool really has a long history in that sort of sense, with some pretty humble beginnings. And we had spoken just a little bit before we started the podcast, and Marsha, you were on the initial preschool committee when it all got started. So can you kind of tell us a little bit more about the committee itself and kind of the wheels in motion for it?
Well, the committee was made of, you know, some educators, but also a lot of at-large people in the congregation that I guess Eva chose, or they volunteered to be a part of that. I just remember, you know, being asked to serve, and I'm not really sure how all the others came about, but it was a great group. There were probably a dozen or more folks that contributed to that first committee.
That's awesome. So it sounds like there was a lot of different backgrounds and different people with different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it all came together.
It did. They worked hard. But it was fun. It was fun. It was kind of daunting in a way, starting from scratch, but it all worked out.
So as director for 16 years, you kind of had your hands in all sort of aspects of the preschool. What were some of those items that were part of your role in that position?
Well, just managing the classrooms, replacing teachers when they moved on to something else. Some years we didn't have anybody leave, but some years we had four or five. But other than the administrative part, planning activities that not necessarily within the classroom, but like, you know, we started right off having chapel. We had someone do music. We've done some different things, but music and chapel have been standard every year. And the special things that we do, like trunk or treat, we used to be a part of the whole church trunk or treat. Then when that went by the wayside, the teachers loved that so much that they wanted to continue doing that. And I will say, during COVID, that allowed us to have an activity that parents could be a part of. And so we've continued to do that. We always have a big crowd. A lot of parents want to come and participate in that, and it's fun. We've had a Christmas program every year. The threes and fours put on a Christmas program for the parents. And that's always really special. The teachers put a lot of time and effort into that. But, you know, I think last year we probably had over 300 people come for that program.
Wow. So kind of what does a Christmas program look like for the preschool?
Well, I mean, it's pretty short and sweet, but the children will almost always have some kind of costume on. The three-year-olds usually just sing or do something very simple. The four-year-olds do more like a little, they may act out a book about the Christmas story. And almost always it's faith-based. Their story or their song has a faith message in it, which I love, because I realize that some of these parents may not hear about Jesus and Christmas anywhere else. We do have plenty of children and families that are unchurched, and so we try to take every advantage of having the opportunity to give them some Jesus.
Just like we just mentioned, it's a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, chapel, you mentioned, was kind of there from the very, very beginning. Now, Jennifer, Miss Jennifer, as the kids know, who was featured on the last episode of the podcast, I know she's really involved in being part of chapel. Mm-hmm. Now, what does chapel look like for the children?
Jennifer may do something, not necessarily a Bible story, but she does some kind of story that's either character related or talks about love or faith or some aspect of being a follower of Jesus. A lot of times she uses props to help illustrate her message. And we sing. We sing a lot of the songs that we also sing in Sunday school with the preschoolers. She does a great job, just like in children's church. And she also does that for the after school kids. And that, when she does chapel with the after-school kids, it's interactive. A lot of times she uses a Bible story as her jumping-off point, but a lot of times they'll play a game, they'll sing, and it's really special. The children are really learning the stories of the Bible and the teachings of Jesus, and I'm so grateful to her for giving her time to do that.
The preschool here is a half-day program. Can you kind of describe what the children's day looks like with the half-day program?
Well, it varies a little bit from classroom to classroom, but one thing that's pretty standard in preschools is a time of free play where they either go to a center for a certain amount of time, depends on how structured the classroom is. The activities change from time to time. A lot of the teachers will change their centers that the children go to. But during that time, there's usually opportunity for the children to participate in some kind of art activity or craft or Play-Doh, things like that.
All the fun stuff.
All the fun stuff, yeah. Lots of hands-on activities, but they're also in a situation where they can play with other children, whether it's role-playing or pretend. You know, they might be making ice cream, or they might be a superhero, or, you know, all kinds of things happen in there, depending on the season. A lot of the teachers use the seasons as their themes.
Definitely. And just kind of a personal experience here, if you walk down the preschool hallway, you can see the teachers' creativity and the themes that they pull through their entire rooms, you know, from Dr. Seuss to Under the Big Top, like a circus theme. It's just amazing what the teachers at the preschool come up with.
They are very creative. They have lots of fun. And I've always told them that they just make me look good, you know. they're the reason that the preschool is successful, because they give the children engaging and stimulating activities to do, along with, you know, skills that are appropriate for children to develop at that age.
Now, with your background of being a teacher, how hard was the transition from being a kindergarten teacher to being a preschool director?
Well, I just kind of had to learn as I went, because all the forms that we use now, except for the registration form, which Jody Pardue shared with me, I just had to create them and make them usable for, you know, whatever we needed. You know, the beauty of being the director is you get to go to all the classrooms. you know, and I get to greet the children in the morning, and, you know, it's very different than being in the classroom, but it's also fun. I get to see all of them. And I've had three great nieces, a great nephew, and two grandsons come to the preschool while I've been here. So that's, you know, that's been an added joy.
So as the director for 16 years, have you had any children that have started the preschool and that have already kind of come back and graduated high school? Have you had any of those?
Yeah, we have some that work in the after-school program.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, we do. Yeah,
we're bringing it full circle here.
Mm-hmm. I think 2 years ago was our first group that had been in started in readiness that first year and graduated from high school.
So what were some of your favorite activities or favorite memories that you may want to share with our listeners about your time of being preschool director?
Well, I love the extra activities that we do, like Trunk or Treat, the Dr. Seuss Parade. The teachers love Dr. Seuss. So we have a parade and invite all the parents. The Christmas program, the teachers pretty much pull that off themselves, but it's so wonderful to watch and to see the children become engaged in the story that they're telling or the songs that they're singing. And it's fun getting to know the children. I always love it when they walk by. If I'm in my office and they walk by, they wave and they say hello to me, and, you know, it's really, really more just the day-to-day interactions with the teachers and the children I really like.
So a moment ago you mentioned the after school. So when the preschool was first developed, there was no after school, correct?
Right.
So kind of how did it transition from we have a half-day preschool to we have an after school program? How did that happen?
Well, two of the teachers in 2016 or 17 came to me and said, I think we need an after-school program. And, you know, so we talked about, it was the spring of 2016. So we talked about what they were thinking of, and, you know, we went to the committee with an idea, and in the fall of 2016, we opened an after-school program. And it took some of the same steps as opening the preschool. You know, we had to find a room to house them in. We worked with the local elementary schools, because we have children from Forsyth County and Davidson County. Since we're on the line, we have children from Freeburg Elementary and Northwest Elementary. Those are the children that we have to pick up with the buses. Then Clemens Elementary, Ward, and Kimmel Farm are in the zone that also come in this area. So any children from those schools are dropped off by the public school buses. So we had to do a little advertising, and we started out small. We met in a small classroom where the fourth and fifth graders meet now. We started out in there, but we soon outgrew that and were able to move to the youth room.
So how many kids are typically enrolled in the after-school program?
During the school year, we've had 32, 34. We have to limit the number from Freeburg because we only have 28 seats on two buses.
Oh, okay.
So we have to have a seat for them. Northwest Elementary this year, we had about 10 from them. Yeah, so that's grown too. We've had fewer children from Forsyth County the last few years, but you know, that kind of thing just kind of comes and goes. One thing I wanted to mention is that we've been able to offer scholarship tuition assistance to families who need partial payment, who for whatever reason aren't able to pay full tuition. But I think that's part of our mission, is the outreach and the ministering to families whose children will benefit from being in the preschool, but the tuition is sometimes a hardship. And so we've had a scholarship fund for quite some time, and I just think it's a blessing to be able to offer that. Of course, we have fundraisers that give us additional money for classroom supplies and also for scholarships.
Do you want to talk about any of those fundraisers in particular?
Well, the consignment sale that Circle 4 does is very beneficial to us, and they've been super generous over the years. Of course, I don't even remember who did it initially. I think it might have been another circle or group, but they always share their proceeds with us, and we've sold coupon books, and we've done all kinds of things like that. We have been able to do two bigger fundraisers for one, a child who has left heart syndrome, who was in our preschool. We did a fundraiser for him, and we did one for Bethany Goodman several years ago. We also every year collect cereal for Crisis Control, their We Care program. So I think it's important that children are aware that there are children in their area that don't have everything that they have. And I also like for parents to have the opportunity to make a contribution to a need outside of their home.
So Marcia, we mentioned in your bio at the very beginning that you're recently retired. We are blessed to have a brand new preschool director that has just joined the staff here at the church. Do you want to talk about her for a moment and kind of this transition process?
Well, one of the many beautiful things about April is that she's been with the preschool and the after-school program since it started. She was one of the teachers that came to me and said, we need an after-school program. And several years ago, we made her the after-school coordinator because that's what she was already doing. So she was already doing the scheduling and the planning. In the summer, the children come for a full day. And so that takes a lot more planning, which she does an absolute wonderful job of. So she always already has a good foundation of, you know, how the preschool operates. The administrative part is the time consuming and the part that she's not as familiar with, but she's learning and it'll be fine.
I know everyone is super excited about her stepping into this position because she's got the background and she's been with the preschool and kind of knows the inner workings. So it's just a passing of the baton.
Yep, it is.
So what are your hopes going forward with the preschool? We talk about 250 years and the preschool is just a drop in the bucket, but it's a ministry, it's an outreach. But what's your hope for it?
Well, I hope it continues to thrive. And I don't have any reason to think that it won't. I want you know, I want the teachers and April to make it their own. You know, I look forward to seeing what new and fun things she comes up with. You know, everybody teaches and manages things in their own way. So, you know, I just look forward to seeing it continue. You know, I've told them that, you know, God has blessed this preschool all along. He's not going to stop now. He's, especially if, you know, if the preschool itself continues to honor Him and maintain the purpose that it was set out to be all along.
So, Marcia, if somebody wants to find out more about the preschool, how would they go about doing that?
They can email from the preschool website, or they can call the preschool office, which is 336-764-1840, and April will get back to you. If she doesn't answer, leave her a message. She will call you back.
Marcia, thank you so much for talking about the preschool here, kind of the development, the timeline of kind of how it started, where it is now, and it's a thriving place for children can learn and grow in their spirit and their faith. So we thank you for everything that you've done over the past 16 years, and we're excited about the future. So we can't wait to see how it's going to thrive and what's going to happen going forward. So thank you so much for diving in and giving us a little history of it. It's been great sitting down and speaking with you today.
Thank you for your questions, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about something that I love.
Well, thank you, Marcia, so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We want to welcome to the podcast Ashley Hart, who will be reading the Moravian Daily Text for Tuesday, August the 1st.
For me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, to tell of all your works. Psalm 73:28. Other refuge have I none, hangs my helpless soul on thee. Leave me not alone, still support and comfort me. All my trust on thee is stayed, all my help from thee I bring. Cover my defenseless head with the shadow of thy wing. He entered the temple with Peter and John, walking and leaping and praising God. Acts 3:8. Should not I for gladness leap, led by Jesus and a sheep? For when these blessed days are over, to the arms of my dear Savior, I shall be conveyed to rest. Amen ye, my lot is blessed. God, when we talk about you and your goodness, we do feel closer to you and know you as our strength and our refuge. May we never keep to ourselves with what have experienced of your love and your care. Amen.
We've made it to the end of today's historical journey, and we thank you for joining us for episode 13 of the podcast. A huge thank you to Jimmy Snyder for joining us today, a thank you to Marcia Wright, and a huge thank you to Ashley Hart for reading today's Moravian Daily Text. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and while you're at it, follow Freeburg Moravian Church on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and be sure to check out our church website, freeburg.church. If you live in the Winston-Salem, North Carolina area, or if you're visiting, join us for worship on Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. We'd love for you to join us here on the Hill of Peace.